three-dimensional structure of the 50S ribosome, which was determined by Tom Steitz and Peter Moore and their colleagues at Yale. And it just illustrates two things, both the magnitude of the self-assembly problem for RNA and RNA protein complexes. So this is almost your worst case scenario. There's 3,000 nucleotides of RNA, 30 proteins that must interact with the RNA. The white squiggly lines is the RNA, the yellow tubes gives a ribbon diagram of the proteins. If you could see, you can't see from this picture, but if you could see if this was colored to show the sequence of the RNA, you would see that the topology of the RNA and the structure is in fact quite complex. And the proteins are really interdigitated among the residues of the RNA. So as Peter and Tom Steitz would point out, the assembly of this complex is certainly a daunting task. Although bacteria have no problem with it whatsoever. And I should say that, in fact, actually in cells, there are other proteins that participate in the assembly of this. Many of them are ATPases. And so, in fact, in biology, by the time you get to a structure of this size, self-assembly is really no longer sufficient, and there must be other catalysts to help propel the process along. And in addition to these very stable RNA protein complexes, there are a myriad of complexes that involve either portions of messenger RNAs or other stable RNAs in cells. And these complexes are absolutely essential for controlling the expression of genes, not only in bacteria, but particularly in higher organisms like our cells. And so from the biologist's point of view, the interest in understanding how these RNA structures are formed and in turn how they interact with proteins in the cell is really of paramount importance. So people's first began to think about structure in RNA really with the determination of the three-dimensional structure of tRNAs in the 70s, because that made it apparent that base pairing interactions, Watson-Crick base pairing interactions, this is taken from a biochemistry textbook, which are illustrated over here in the secondary structure diagram of the RNA, is not really sufficient to describe the functional structure, which is shown on the right. It turns out that not only do you have the double helices here, which you can see an example of, but the tertiary structure is formed by interactions between these loops, which is up in this corner, and by a large number of hydrogen bonding interactions, not Watson-Crick hydrogen bonding interactions. And the other thing that became apparent was that interactions between the RNA and positively charged ions, particularly multivalent metal ions such as magnesium, and also polyamines such as spermine or spermidine, were very important for stabilizing the tertiary structure of the RNA. So the other thing that happened then in the 70s is that people became interested not only in what the structure of the RNA is, but the dynamics of the structure. And there were a large number of experiments done primarily by people coming out of Manfred Eigen's lab, but also in Nacho Tinoco's lab and Paul Doty's lab as well, to look at both the dynamics of forming the helices and the tertiary structure. And I'll just summarize this very quickly. But in general, what people found was that while the local base pairing interactions, the secondary structure, could often form on the microsecond time scale, and that in part depends to some extent on the entropic penalty for closing loops, for example, to form hairpins. So this you could arrive at in microseconds. Tertiary interactions seem to appear a little bit more slowly, often on the 10 to 100 millisecond time scales. But the other thing that people saw almost immediately was that certain tRNA sequences did not fold in the millisecond time scale. They required seconds or longer. And for those sequences, the temperature dependence of the reaction, the activation energy, was in fact notably higher than for those sequences in which the RNA folded very rapidly in milliseconds. And so that immediately began to point to this idea that at least certain sequences of RNA are prone to becoming trapped or occupying alternative states that must first break apart, unfold, before they can refold. So actually, I have to say, when I go back and read the literature from the 70s, I feel like all I am doing these days is just relearning what they knew 30 years ago. It's not quite that bad, but tRNA told people an awful lot. So what the experiments I'm going to be telling you about are on a sort of intermediate size RNA, smaller than ribosomes, but much larger than tRNA. And it's this ribozyme that is well characterized by Tom Cech's lab and many others. It occurs in the pre-ribosomal RNA in tetrahymena thermophila. I think you've heard a little bit about this already yesterday from Nacho Tinoco. So just to review very quickly, it's about 400 nucleotides long, so that means its molecular weight is about 130,000. The structure can be roughly broken into several domains of tertiary interactions. The one highlighted in green that I think Nacho talked about probably quite a bit is quite stable. These sequences can fold independently of the rest of the ribozyme. And as you'll see in a moment, this domain can also form native contacts fairly rapidly on the second time scale, actually faster than that. There's another domain that's much less stable. It cannot fold independently. Tends to form on the minutes time scale. And the active site that's responsible for the catalytic properties of this RNA is formed by close interactions between these helices over here and these helices over here. So this structure is highly compact. And you can get a feel for that in this transparency or slide, which is taken from a it's a ribbon diagram from a 5-angstrom crystal structure determined by Barb Golden when she was in Tom Cech's lab. And so here's that stable domain. It was green on the previous slide, sorry. And you can see that it folds over on itself. It forms a very compact structure. The other domain that's less stable is shown in green here. It kind of wraps around purple. This is a top-down view of the same structure. So you can see that that there's very close contacts, and if this were drawn in a space-filling diagram rather than just a ribbon diagram, you could see that the interior here is quite well packed. It's a fairly tight structure. And the active site is right here in a little crevice that's formed between these two helices. There are some other helices that are present in the natural RNA that are not shown in this diagram that function to stabilize this structure. They're proposed by Eric Westhoff and François Michel to wrap essentially around the exterior of this, kind of almost like a seatbelt holding the whole thing together. All right, so that's what this thing looks like. So the challenge for people then in the RNA community was to begin to not only measure the kinetics of folding, but people wanted to have some more detailed information about which sequences within the RNA were becoming ordered, at what kinds of times. And so people have used a variety of experimental approaches. One that was used by Jamie Williamson and his colleagues was to use oligonucleotides, DNA oligonucleotides that are complementary to the RNA. And the idea here is that if the RNA is unfolded, that the complementary oligonucleotide can base pair with it. They can detect that by cleaving the RNA with an enzyme ribonuclease H, and hence it's a way of detecting the unstructured regions of the RNA. We took a slightly different approach, and the emphasis was to primarily look at the tertiary contacts in the RNA. And we made use of chemistry that has been known for some time and was developed primarily by Tom Tullius and his colleagues to look at nucleic acid conformation. So the idea here, and this has been known from radiation biology as well, is that if you generate some hydroxyl radical in solution, the radical will react with the nucleic acid. And one of the things that happens is that the ribose sugar in the nucleic acid is oxidized, and this eventually leads to cleavage of the RNA strand. So a hydroxyl radical will result in cleavage of the RNA. If the RNA is fairly unstructured, I mean that there can be base pairing interactions, but just no tertiary contacts, then the radical will actually react fairly nonspecifically with the entire RNA. And you can analyze the fragments that result from this reaction by running it on a sequencing gel, in this cartoon. And what you would see is just this smooth ladder of cleavage products, which arise really from just random cleavage everywhere in the sequence. In contrast, the RNA is structured, and it turns out in this case we require some magnesium ion for this ribozyme to fold. Now some of the residues will be on the interior of the structure, less accessible to the radical in solution, and hence you will see that some residues in the RNA are not cleaved as rapidly. And for us, the RNA is labeled with P32. It means that we can detect it with great sensitivity. Cleavage patterns on the gels, I know this seems very low-tech, but it works, and you can actually quantitate the intensity of each of these products and obtain information about both the equilibrium and the kinetics of folding. So the key here is that typically what biochemists would do to produce such a gel, such an experiment, would be to generate the hydroxyl radical using Fenton chemistry, iron 2 EDTA complexes. And those reactions usually take, in practical terms, about 30 seconds to 2 minutes to carry out. So you can imagine that would be okay for looking at equilibrium structures, but it would not be sufficient for looking at transient conformations or complexes. So what we did with the folks at Albert Einstein was to instead use a synchrotron X-ray beam to generate the hydroxyl radical in solution by photolysis of the water. And since the flux of energy coming through the beam that we're using is fairly high, the cleavage reactions can be carried out in, it depends on the beam current, but say 10 to 30, sometimes as high as 50 milliseconds of exposure time, but we can do as low as 5 to 10 milliseconds. We've just used a rapid mixing apparatus to carry out the folding reactions that's just been placed within the X-ray beam. Maybe a better schematic is on this slide. I'm sorry, I put this in upside down. Actually, does somebody mind just fixing that for me? I'm going to just flip it around. I rarely do this kind of thing. But. This one is hard to read upside down. Thank you. Idea here is that you just, I messed up the focus, I'm sorry. The idea is that you would carry out the mixing reaction using the stop flow apparatus, and so the RNA is in buffer and it's under conditions in which the base pairing interactions are stable. So presumably we have quite a bit of secondary structure at the start of this reaction, but very little or no tertiary structure. Then the RNA is then rapidly mixed with a solution containing magnesium chloride so it can begin to form tertiary structure. We wait for some time, push the RNA into a flow cell that has been that's placed in the X-ray beam, irradiate, and then collect the samples. And then the bad part is we have to take them all home and run them on sequencing gels. But again, we would get this kind of pattern, just shown schematically here. These are real data. So you can see that we can quantify the increase in the degree to which these sequences are protected with folding time. This is just an example. For this, these residues are becoming protected in, say, a few seconds or so. That's absolutely correct. There may be some base pairing elements, in fact, there undoubtedly are, that are not stable enough to really persist in the absence of magnesium. So it's not to say that there's no further base pairing that must occur, but certainly all the local base pairing interactions are apparently there. Actually, yes, and we have done those experiments. So we can take the RNA and start off in high concentrations of urea, which we know it's fairly well. Even the secondary contacts are unfolded, and we get very, very similar results. That's correct. Yes.
In the gel, as you move over towards the folded side, one of those blobs is going to be a combination of different strands of them. Is that right?
Absolutely.
So how do they stay together after You put them in the gel, you have to keep them together somehow.
I see. I think I misunderstood your question. So this gel is actually a denaturing gel. So once the RNA is cleaved, it will fall apart. And so there are only one end of the RNA has been labeled with the P32, the 5' end for us. And so you'll see just the 5' fragment, and the length of that will differ. And hence, yeah. I thought you were asking, I mean, this is a solution experiment, so there's many molecules, that, you know, this is not a single molecule experiment. I thought that's what you were asking at first. Yeah. All right. So Bianca did these kinds of experiments on the tetrahymen ribozyme, and what she found was that different residues in different parts of the structure were becoming ordered at different rates. And in fact, it was residues that are keyed in green and orange that are part of this stable domain that were protected most rapidly. So the ones in green are those residues that would be protected from cleavage when just this little P5ABC domain that you heard Nacho speak about yesterday folds up. And in fact, it is one of the regions of this whole structure that forms most rapidly on average. And that was followed shortly by residues that would be protected when this whole domain, P4 through P6 domain, folds up upon itself. So a little more slowly, but about 1 per second under these conditions. And then there were some other patches here in pink, these that are ordered a little more slowly, about 0.3 per second or so. And these are regions that will become protected when actually those helices that you haven't really seen much about that go around the outside of the structure are ordered. And the most, the residues that became structured or at least have native structure most slowly were those in the this domain. This is the least stable domain. They're the patches in yellow. And again, these residues are form part of the active site of the ribozyme, and in fact are very near the center of the native structure when it's folded. And that's just summarized in this cartoon here, where it just kind of gives you this progression here of native structure with time. So on average, again, this P4, P6 domain is ordered much shorter times than these other helices that go around the exterior of the structure, and what takes the longest time to become fully ordered are these residues here in this so-called P3, P8 domain, this domain that we know is not particularly stable.
Does that correspond to the rate of recovery of activity?
Yes, it does. Yes, so this minute time scale corresponds very well to that. And these data matched well with experiments that had been done in Jamie Williamson's lab using that oligonucleotide hybridization method that I alluded to earlier. They again found that residues in this so-called P3, P8 domain were folded on the sort of minute time scale, and that was in contrast to this P4, P6 domain. So these data, and you know, again, data from a variety of laboratories, enabled us to begin to draw several conclusions. First of all, should I answer your question first?
How much does the rate constant depend on the magnesium concentration?
It turns out that it depends considerably on the amount of magnesium and other cationes that are present in solution. And we haven't, yes. And as you'll see in a moment, actually, the folding rates actually decrease with increasing magnesium concentration. So these experiments were done at 42 degrees Celsius with 10 millimolar sodium cacodylate, so very low ionic strength in our starting conditions. And then we are adding 10 millimolar magnesium chloride, which is very much more than sufficient to stabilize the native structure. So from this we could conclude, yes?
And for the misfolded structure, is that a unique structure or is that ensemble?
The misfolded structure, it's undoubtedly an ensemble. And you will see maybe some data that supports that conclusion in just a couple slides. Yes?
Well,
proton exchange.
Oh, yes. This has some affinity with that.
There's always this distinction made between the two different mechanisms of whether the proton exchange is a rate limiting step or not. In this case, we can assume that the chemical reaction is infinitely fast relative to the folding.
That's right. We're sort of ensuring that that's the case because we're only pulsing the beam on for a defined period of time, and it's usually no more than 50 milliseconds, but far more typically 10 to 20 milliseconds. So that's yes. So they react very quickly. In fact, they recombine with each other at a diffusion limited time scale. And so in fact, actually during that 10 milliseconds that the beam is on, it's really like a mini steady state because, you know, electron packets are hitting the sample and inducing some hydroxyl radical, but the radical is either rapidly recombining with itself or reacting with the RNA. Most of them, radicals probably never see RNA. And so we've estimated the steady state concentrations of radicals during that 10 millisecond pulse to be between 10 to the minus 6 and 10 to the minus 7 molar, which is actually very high compared to what you can achieve through other methods. Yeah. Yeah, so, but in any case, you know, even 50 milliseconds is short relative to a second. Yep. Yeah. So we could conclude from this that at least some parts of the RNA appear to reach the native structure on a relatively fast time scale, not a really fast time scale, but, you know, seconds. Okay. But there were other regions of the RNA that were not becoming ordered. So that certainly that said right away that this large RNA did not fold in a simple two-state fashion. Certainly was folding on time scales that are much longer than what people saw for some tRNAs, which are about 76-ish residues. And again, pointed up to the fact that we must have presumably an ensemble of intermediates so that there are some very slow transitions that are occurring from these intermediates to the native structure. But the very slow transitions occurred very late in this overall scheme. In other words, tertiary contacts were already present for a very large fraction of the RNA in these structures, and it was really only a relatively small fraction of the sequence that had not yet reached the native structure. So it suggested that these intermediates did contain quite a bit of structure, and that perhaps is going to account for these slow folding rates. So. Right, so this, of course, is a way of that people can explain this kind of behavior that's probably very familiar to people in this audience. So this is part I don't have to worry about explaining here. And as you can imagine, we're undoubtedly starting with a very large ensemble of extended structures before we've added magnesium to the solution. And so once we've added magnesium, now the tertiary contacts are going to be stable. And what theory would predict, and agrees with the experimental data that people have so far, is that as soon as the magnesium is added, the RNA will immediately begin to form many interactions and begin to arrive at structures that are far more compact. But as this ensemble of chains begins to fold, what we are certainly seeing for these long RNAs is that there's a great tendency to form intermediates, and again, that could be best explained by the fact that there could be many local minima in this energy landscape, many competing basins of attraction, that would explain why very long times were required for the formation of the native structure. Again, if these states are quite stable, very high energy barriers would need to be traversed in these slow folding steps. So if all of these predictions were correct, then we would have expected that conditions that would destabilize these intermediates that, again, we presumed contained some amount of non-native contacts as well as presumably many native contacts as well. So we would expect the conditions that should destabilize these structures slightly would then accelerate the overall formation of the native structure. We should see that effect primarily on these very late, slow transitions that are occurring, and presumably not on the earlier fast transitions. So some of the kind of very early experiments, here's our little scheme that's just showing this model, and it's reminding me to point out one other thing that's probably obvious to all of you, and this is that not only do we expect then some of the population to be trapped in these misfolded or alternative states, but of course we do expect a tiny fraction of the RNA population to be able to fold rapidly, you know, directly into the native structure. If we really have a diverse population of extended states, and if we are really looking at a partitioning of the RNA population between various pathways, and again, we, yeah. All right, so it turned out, and I should say that it was just about this time in the whole story that my lab and Dave Thrumalai's lab's paths sort of converged. He was thinking about these things for protein folding. And at the same time, we had already knew experimentally that we had these alternative structures present in our RNA. And we could use a very humble but effective technique for separating those, which is native polyacrylamide gel electrophoresis. And in part, this works because the transitions between these alternative structures, in our case, and the native structure are so slow that they can be trapped by electrophoresis. And you can see an example of this. This is an RNA, a precursor RNA that contains the tetrahymenoribozyme. So this RNA is about 650 nucleotides long. And if we just take it, we've synthesized in the lab and loaded on one of these gels, you can see that the population is sort of distributed in this big smear here. Although there's a tiny amount that's running, migrating a little bit more rapidly through the gel. And in these experiments, molecules that are more compact on average typically migrate more rapidly. We were able to do experiments to show that, in fact, it's this material that is, corresponds to the catalytically active RNA. So it is presumably in the native structure. So, yes? This is pre, yes. And this particular RNA is 657 nucleotides long. And the ribozyme is 400 approximately. So long chain. Right. So if we took the RNA and incubated it in magnesium for a little while before loading on the gel, now you see much more of it is appearing as the native material. We could alternatively try to anneal the RNA by heating it to a very high temperature and recooling it actually in a very brief period of time. And that's this lane over here. And again, nearly now all of the material, most of it, is in the active structure. So we had kinetically, you know, long-lived intermediates that we could see, we could trap by these gels, and these species can convert with one another, and the rate of that conversion is very sensitive to temperature, is accelerated at high temperatures.
Is
there
very light band?
Yes.
More compact?
Oh, this down here? It turns out that it's a slightly shorter fragment of RNA. So, which we could, we knew why it was there, we could control for. And then this is just the free intron itself that has spliced out. So we know that from other experiments that everything that's between here and here corresponds to that 650 chain length. Yep. So if this annealing procedure that we could do experimentally, very simple one, was having the effect of allowing the RNA population to repartition among native and these alternative states, misfolded states, then you would predict that if you could just continually re-anneal the RNA, eventually you should be able to drive all of it into the native structure. And this idea is actually familiar probably to you from computer simulated annealing algorithms. So we can do this experimentally, and this is the starting material. Very little of it is native. If we re-anneal once, can drive about 70 to 80% of it into the native structure. If we then take the remaining material that didn't fold correctly, re-anneal it again, we'll get a little bit more. So what we're plotting here is the cumulative amount of native material after various cycles of annealing. And you can see eventually, you know, it will all fold by this.
Does that mean you're cutting it out of the gel?
Yes, that means we're cutting it out.
And then rerunning in the gel.
That's correct.
Just cutting out
the non-native stuff, and that's right. So if we didn't purify on each round and we just re-annealed, we would actually expect to just see this ratio repeating.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's equally.
In fact, actually, that works. We did do that control. That's what you get.
So if you don't anneal, how long do you have to wait to?
A long time in some cases, depending on every salts and temperature, anywhere from 20 minutes to 4 hours. And you know that also points out to Tetrahymena is a unicellular organism. It has to make RNA and divide, you know, every couple hours or so. So these kinds of timescales are not biologically sufficient. And one of my undergraduates once commented, "I don't think Tetrahymena can anneal its RNA at 95 degrees Celsius. It grows at 30 degrees Celsius." So the other prediction is that denaturance should accelerate the overall appearance of native material. And you can see that from this experiment. What you're looking at here is, again, we're starting off at early times, and you can see this large smear of material. So this, again, suggests that we are looking at a very large ensemble of structures. And there's a tiny amount of native material that appears very early, again, consistent with the prediction that some small fraction of the population should partition into folding pathways that lead rapidly to the native structure. And for this sequence, that is about 5 to 10% of the material.
Back on the previous slide, it seems like that value of 5 for the first round is extremely. I don't know which one is 5, which one's 1 minus 5. The folding fraction on the first round is much, much smaller than the folding fraction when you take the stuff that hasn't folded, heat it up, and cool it down again.
Actually, it's not. It's probably just confusing from this particular graph, the way we plotted it, because this is the cumulative amount. So this increase here. Is what?
Between 0 and 1.
Oh, from 0 and 1. So this is, yes, so this is no annealing at all. So the RNA was just maintained at 30 degrees after it was synthesized. And so this points out to the fact that under the, yes, you're right, under those conditions, the fraction folded. And here, I think it was incubated at a minute or something, and we have only 13% folded. So that high temperature. Is essential for driving a greater fraction of the RNA into the native structure.
So that means that the high temperature state is much easier than the native state when it's just synthesized.
Right, so what we presume happens is that when the RNA chain is synthesized at 30 or 37 degrees, immediately as the chain is being extruded from the polymerase, you can begin to have base pairing contacts form. And so we presume that that as that is happening, it produces really a very, again, diverse ensemble of structures, probably, you know, which almost none appear to be native. So if we're starting with that ensemble, then this is more or less what we get. And so that high temperature is really required to unfold the chain. Yep.
Okay, at the high temperature, 65 or 95, is there still all the base stacking interactions, or do you get rid of the secondary structure as well?
95 is certainly sufficient to remove most of the secondary structure. 65 is the midpoint for unfolding of the tertiary interactions, but many of the stems will still be stable, or at least marginally stable at 65 degrees. But there are a few key interactions that we know about, we knew about after these experiments, that would no doubt be unfolded at 65 degrees. We would love to know that. No, we don't know. So this is this intron or ribozyme is embedded in the pre-ribosomal RNA, of course. And from what people do know about ribosome biogenesis, it appears that both the ribosomal proteins and probably many other proteins are again interacting with the transcript as it is being synthesized. So that could, of course, shift the equilibrium between these competing structures in ways that we don't know, understand. That's one potential solution to the problem. I don't know if it's the solution. Yes, and we can. We've estimated the rate of splicing and hence folding in vivo to be about 20 to 50 times more rapid than what we're seeing in these experiments. We've never gotten that kind of rate acceleration using extracts, though we've certainly tried. But we have some hope. Actually, recently we've had some success. So maybe. Hervé is asking, are there other group 1 introns from other species that are known to fold more rapidly? And people haven't looked at very many. I probably won't get there, but at the very end of my talk, I have some slides from a much smaller group 1 intron, one of the smallest sequences known. It's about 200. This is the one from Azoarchis. And that one, it does appear to be folding much more rapidly in our hands. Maybe not unsurprisingly, the sequence is shorter. Okay. Well, yes. This is a case in which we're using the gel to follow the appearance of the native material over time, over 2 hours. I should just say that the gel is running continuously during the experiment, so. This lane has been loaded 2 hours after that one, which is why it has not migrated as far into the gel. So one can obtain an apparent rate constant for the appearance of this material, the native RNA. And when you compare the rate constants in the absence and the presence of urea, you see that the urea does accelerate the overall folding rate. And you can even see that just by eye looking at the gel. So 1 minute we have a fair bit of folded material here, whereas we have very little here. This is a 0.8 molar urea. The midpoint of the urea denaturation curve is about 2 or 2.5 molar, I recall. So if one looks at the fraction, so the kinetics that we observe are always multiphasic, unsurprisingly. And if you look at the fraction of RNA that folds in the more rapid kinetic phase, it begins to increase for a little while until finally the amplitude of the folding reaction begins to drop off as we destabilize the native structure. But the rate constant for the transition, the observed rate constant, increases with urea concentration. And it does so even under conditions in which the native structure is still stable.
So what does urea do to the structure?
It denatures RNA. I'm not sure it's understood how it does it any better than it's understood how it denatures proteins. It certainly will disrupt not only tertiary contacts, but also base-base interactions, base stacking and hydrogen bonds. Yeah?
I'm curious, this is the fraction that is folding quickly.
I'm being sloppy. So we actually see at least three kinetic phases. There's the stuff that is folded in the first time that we can detect by this method, which is really about 15 to 30 seconds. The time resolution of the gels is, very poor. So there's that stuff. And that is maybe increases very slightly with urea concentration, but not much, if at all. And then there's another fraction that folds with a time constant usually of about, a minute or so, something like that. And that's what you're looking here. And then there's another bunch of stuff that folds like, time constant of about an hour or something. Yeah. Okay. Yes, you can do the fits and it's all clear cut. Conversely, magnesium chloride, which would stabilize tertiary interactions in RNA, and you can see that here, we're plotting the extent of native RNA that's formed versus magnesium concentration, and you can see that it does undergo a very cooperative transition with respect to the magnesium concentration. as one might expect. But again, at the same time, the overall observed rate for the transition decreases as you increase magnesium. So all of these data were at least qualitatively, if not quantitatively. Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
The sodium fractions never go too wide, so it's separate.
That's correct. That's right. And
depends on the time scale?
Yeah, somewhat to the time scale, although many of these reactions were done for 4 hours. So it depends a little bit on the sequence of the RNA and the conditions, but we often see that folding is not going to 100%. So from that we infer that there's some remaining fraction of the population that is in such kinetically long-lived states that essentially is never folding under our conditions. And you can increase that to about 80 to 90% if you do these high temperature annealing. So again, we assume that it is a kinetic problem, it's not a thermodynamic problem. The ribozyme, which is the 400, those folding reactions were more typically go to 85 to 95% completion. Yes?
If you take the unfolded fraction and start again, mm-hmm. you get the same fraction.
Yes. Yes.
And you're pretty sure the native state is the sort of lowest energy?
We think that the native state is the lowest energy state because high temperature almost always, high temperature and long times always drive it into that conformation. So we presume that that's correct. Yeah. So the magnesium results, again, and the urea results can be understood, again, in at least a qualitative way from a very simple landscape model in which we would presume that these slow transitions, again, are due to the requirement for unfolding stable and non-native structures. And again, if you decrease the amount of magnesium, so the red line, the rates of the transitions from these states to the native state should increase a little bit because these intermediates have been destabilized. Of course, the native structure will also be destabilized. And there's one other thing that comes out of these analyses that I'm not showing clearly here, but the native structure, as you saw, responds very steeply to magnesium concentration. So the transition from the unfolded to the folded states is very strongly dependent on magnesium. And you can calculate these kinds of M values that protein folders calculate to look at the change in the free energy of the native state as a function of magnesium or urea concentrations. The intermediates, which are the non-native intermediates, which are have reason to expect are a little bit less compact and certainly less ordered, are also stabilized by magnesium, but in a far less cooperative way. So in other words, the free energy of the intermediate states responds less sensitively to changes in magnesium concentration than the free energy of the native state. That seems okay. Again, you can at least predict in a very qualitative way the equilibrium and the observed rate of the folding reactions just using this kind of very simple-minded sort of model. Yeah?
When you do the fragment analysis, is there any evidence of non-native protection?
So this is the hydroxyl radical. So yes, do we see any evidence of non-native protections? No. Although we looked. And so from that, what we presume or we guess is the explanation is that the intermediates, at least in terms of tertiary structure, are heterogeneous. And so because the unstructured parts of the RNA are not coherent, we would never detect the kind of protection patterns from those structures. Yes?
You showed the threshold concentration of magnesium.
Yes.
Like 4 millimolar.
Yes.
Does it depend on concentration of sodium chloride?
Absolutely. The sodium ions compete with with the magnesium. So as you increase the concentration of sodium, the midpoint of the magnesium transition moves to higher concentrations.
So this is the point where magnesium replaces the sodium?
That's one way of thinking of it, yes. That's okay, yep. Yes? So it turns out they're due to both. So these metastable states are due to both alternative secondary structures, secondary structure interactions, and presumably also to tertiary interactions. I'm going to see what's on the next slide. Yes, that's what's coming next. You want to take a break now or keep going? We're all right? Okay. Thank you for your question, because that was the next part. Because we could separate the native and the misfolded structures on the gels, my student Jay could use that and a variety of chemical probing methods and mutagenesis to figure out what the difference is in the structures. And one of the things that she came up with was that this base pairing interaction that's part of the active site, and this is the part that is ordered most slowly. I mean, it's protected most slowly in the hydroxyl radical experiments. And it's a pseudonaut interaction. This purple strand is coming in from many nucleotides away, about 150, to pair with this sequence. So that can be replaced by an alternative pairing interaction. And this interaction characterizes at least many, if not all, of those misfolded structures. And as you would predict, mutations that stabilize this structure greatly slow down the rate at which those intermediates convert to the native structure, and mutations that stabilize this would accelerate the folding rates. So it's certainly at least in part an alternative secondary structure, but we know from the X-ray footprinting experiments, the hydroxyl radical cleavage experiments, that there are tertiary contacts that are being formed in this P4, P6 domain fairly early in times. So we presume that those native interactions should also stabilize these metastable states. So this is, I'll come back, I'm getting a little out of order. I said if we stabilize this native contact with a mutation, that should accelerate folding, and it does. So this is the ribozyme, the 400 nucleotide RNA, and again, another one of these native gels, and you can see that we start off with a mixture of non-native states and eventually progress to the native RNA. This is over 10 minutes. This mutation now that stabilizes the native structure, and turns out it also disfavors this alternative pairing. Now nearly 80% of the RNA appears as the active form in the first time that we can see. And again, it takes about 15 to 30 seconds for the RNA to actually load into the gel matrix, so this is not really zero time. And then the remaining material progresses very rapidly to the active form. So Mike Duras, a postdoc in the lab, then did the cleavage experiments on these. Yeah. Oh, why isn't that? Yes, good question. So at least one part of that answer. So the question is, why is this mutation not present in the natural RNA? Evolution should have favored it, it turns out that this mutation does lower the catalytic activity of the ribozyme about 50%. So 50% is probably enough to do the trick. And we've seen that that's true even when we express the RNA in bacteria and this kind of thing. So, yep. That's right. It's always a trade-off, right? Yes? So your question is, can we see differences in the kinetics without the magnesium? It turns out that the native structure will not form in the absence of magnesium at all. So we have to have some small amount of, is that, maybe I'm misunderstanding your question.
You told us that there was a less stable and more stable secondary structure.
Correct, yes. Right.
The question is, how, if you don't bring magnesium, you only have a secondary structure, do you see analogous?
Right. I'm just trying to think how much data has actually been done. There are experiments that were done in Doug Turner's lab many years ago using both the Michael Zucker's computer folding algorithm to fold the RNA and chemical probing methods. Oh, sorry, I'm going the wrong way. I want to back up. And what then? This is how we hit, and part that's helped us hit on this, is that the structure that they predicted was this one. And the computer folding algorithms, A, cannot take tertiary contacts into account, especially the older algorithms, and B, that particular one was not able to handle these kinds of pseudo-knot interactions, which this is. Yes. So we guess, and maybe we have reasons to know, and Doug Turner's data would suggest that this interaction is the preferred one in the absence of magnesium. And I don't know if not Nacho talked about an alternative pairing interaction that's present in this P5ABC domain, but there his lab found the same kind of thing. There's an alternative pairing interaction that's more stable in the absence of the tertiary contacts. All right, so the hydroxyl radical footprinting cleavage experiments on this mutant RNA supported the notion that the mutant was now able to make the transition to the native structure in a much more rapid and concerted way than the wild type. So now for the mutant, which is in red, this domain is still folding at a rate of about 1 per second or so, as it does in the wild type, which is in black. But now this domain, which again became ordered, you know, very slowly in the wild type, is now becoming ordered at almost 1 per second or so for this mutant. So all of these data suggested to us that this mutation changes the partitioning between the competing non-native states and the pathways leading to the native structure. We estimate, you know, there's about 80% of the mutant can fold rapidly. And that's in contrast for about 2% for the wild-type ribosome. So you asked about alternative secondary structures, and then I was saying that tertiary interactions must, we presume, must also help stabilize these misfolded states. And in fact, that there's good evidence for that. So. At first, Jamie Williamson's lab had done some experiments, very clever experiments, in which they tried to select for mutations that would accelerate the overall rate of folding of this domain, which we now know tends to misfold. And the mutations that they came up with, most of them were actually in this P4, P6 domain that folds rapidly. And there are mutations, these aren't their mutations, this is another one, but in general, mutations that destabilize the tertiary structure of this domain accelerate the overall rate of forming active ribozyme. Even though those mutations do destabilize the native structure somewhat, they increase the rate of folding, presumably because they're destabilizing these intermediates, these trapped intermediates. And we also found that mutations that stabilize interactions with those helices that go around the outside of the structure, there's some base pairing interactions between these loops here that hold this thing together. And if we introduce mutations that destabilize those, again, the overall rate at which the RNA folds to the native structure is enhanced, about fivefold. So not huge, but a little bit. So on the one hand, if we introduce mutations that destabilize this P4, P6 domain, which is very stable and independently stable and folds most rapidly in our assays, then we see that the overall rate of folding is enhanced, again, presumably because we've destabilized these intermediates. Conversely, if we introduce mutations that stabilize the least stable domain, this P3 region of the ribozyme, then we find that, the RNA folds much more rapidly to the native structure. So it suggested to Dave Thrumalai that really the problem here for this particular RNA was that there's a gross imbalance in the stabilities of the various regions of the structure. On the one hand, one part is very stable. The other hand, the other is not, and is very prone to competing interactions, secondary structure interactions. And so this combination means that the RNA is very readily trapped in intermediates that are stabilized not only by alternative secondary interactions, base pairing, but also by native tertiary contacts, and in some cases, we now have evidence that there can even be competition between native and non-native tertiary contacts. Yes.
Two new states here.
Yes.
The second, are the same?
Presumably the spectrum of extended states, unfolded states, will depend on the sequence of the RNA. So as we're introducing mutations, no doubt our starting population is changing somewhat. We have absolutely no idea how much. But in both cases, it's still a very large ensemble of structures in the absence of magnesium. Yeah. Okay. Right now? Okay. All right. Maybe we'll get to counterions among all the molecules in the crystal lattice, and so the density, you know, will just not show up. It'll be just averaged out. And so this, the fact that what you see in the crystal structures and the crystal lattices really only corresponds to those very few ions that tend to be very ordered has in part skewed people's understanding of the problem a little bit, at least among biochemists. I don't know, maybe physical chemists aren't fooled, because people assume that those are the only places where there are ions, and of course this cannot be. Yes?
Are there ways of getting an estimate for how many magnesium are associated with
the molecule? Yeah, so, so Draper's lab has done incredible amounts of experiments to try to get at this, and that it has started in again in the late 60s and the 70s on tRNA, and people tried to do these titrations and use scatter plots and various arguments to figure out how many ions and the number that were associated with these so-called high affinity sites, and how many ions were just sort of in a very delocalized cloud around the nucleic acid, and it's an experimentalist nightmare because every phosphate is potentially a magnesium, binding site, right? So you could have 76, divided by 2 magnesiums, right, to make this, or however many nucleotides are in this RNA, right? And they would be neutral. So it's been fraught with difficulties. But in some smaller RNAs, Draper's lab has some evidence to suggest that there's they can, in some cases, they can see evidence for maybe 1 or 2 ion sites that are of very high affinity and where the ion appears to be fairly localized. And then, again, there's this big cloud of ions and nobody can really calculate easily how many there are. Yes?
Have people tried to do genetic replacement studies? Because in that case, you would assume that the tightly bound magnesium ions should exchange more slowly.
That's correct. And so people have looked at some of that by NMR spectroscopy, and in some cases, I believe, by EPR. Nacho can correct me if I'm wrong. And often what people see by those spectroscopic methods is that the ions are, in fact, quite mobile and quite dynamic around the nucleic acid. I don't know if people have looked at the dynamics of some of the higher affinity ions in the hammerhead ribozyme. Vicky DeRose may have some data on that. So it may be that some of these ions are a little, less mobile, a little bit more restricted. Their exchange is slower. But I'm still guessing the exchange rates to be very rapid, and extremely rapid compared to the kinds of folding timescales that we've been looking at.
Yeah.
Very, I mean.
This replacement studies on divalent ions, they have been done, I remember, in the 70s by ultrasound absorption. They are pretty fast.
Uh-huh.
In the nanosecond.
Uh-huh. You would need that kind of resolution, I am guessing, to get at it. Yeah. Yes?
So from the right hand picture, it looks like the ions are likely to stay in a groove of the
Yes, exactly the opposite of what you would expect.
But why some groups, not others? Some, like the some groups are filled by ions, but not
like this one, for example, but not that one. So first of all, you're looking at the two different grooves of the nucleic acid. So this is the so-called this should be the this is the major. They're the deep. Yeah, I think I've got that right. Yes, it should be. Yeah, so that's probably part of it, right there. Yeah. And but then here, you know, you see a region of extremely high negative charge density, and this cannot be just achieved by the regular secondary structure, but really requires an even closer arrangement of the phosphate groups as a result of the tertiary structure of the RNA than what would be achieved in just a uniform double helix. Yes?
One is, I think of proteins where you sort of do molecular dynamics, mm-hmm. which you describe as bright and yellow. If you do molecular dynamics on these things, are these as dynamic as proteins are, so that these are just sort of one snapshot of a large ensemble of states, or are they going to be more solid?
The RNAs are definitely quite dynamic, and I don't have all of the time scales at my fingertips, the results of those calculations. But you could have, again, local motions that are easily within the microsecond time scales. One thing that people are arguing about a little bit is to what extent the folded RNAs have very sort of large-scale motions between helices. So there are some people that argue that these motions are quite significant, of a large amplitude, and again, could be extremely rapid. But extremely rapid could be maybe as slow as milliseconds, possibly. I don't. Maybe Nacho has idea of more data. That I'm not sure people have a good sense of this yet, though.
But here's one other thing. In terms of molecular dynamics, first of all, a lot less of it has been done on nucleic acids than on proteins. And when you, if you use all the force field and everything that people use for proteins and apply to nucleic acids,
they don't work.
Because the solvent is so important in nucleic acids, and in proteins they often ignore the solvent or they treat it in some kind of gross way. And here it's clearly much more important. I think if you take the standard molecular dynamic, I've been told this, I've never done it myself, standard molecular dynamics package that people use for proteins, and you just throw an RNA molecule in there, it just sort of falls apart. Yeah. Which it clearly doesn't do in solution.
Right.
But it just hasn't been worked on nearly as much, and so you wouldn't trust the result that you got in molecular dynamics on RNA.
That's also correct.
You might not trust the proteins either.
This is also true for some protein. the molecules are all together by the boundary conditions.
Well, if you don't run your simulation very long, it won't unfold.
Because you need many more water molecules to get the bioproperties. And the bioproperties stabilize the protein.
Yeah. And maybe it's also worth adding that you cannot recapitulate this kind of effect using the very sort of simple electrostatic models. You have to go to nonlinear Poisson-Boltzmann kind of models to recapitulate this kind of thing, or Brownian dynamics motions has been used in the Westhoff lab. Yeah.
The other question I have is, when I think of tRNA, I sort of think of it in a biochemistry book, but it sort of grabs the and it grabs the RNA and it grabs the protein and sort of brings it together. Is there any physiological importance to its structure other than you need something that long?
The tRNA? Oh, yeah. Actually, there's increasingly beautiful data that suggests that the shape of the tRNA is recognized in a specific way by not only a host of factors that are required to load the amino acids onto the RNA, and you can imagine that this is a big specificity problem that's been worked on quite a bit, because if you put the wrong amino acid on a tRNA, your genetic code is over. So that's critical. And then when the tRNAs are delivered to the ribosome, they interact with the ribosome in quite specific ways. And it's clear that the ribosome is using these interactions to, push the tRNAs and the mRNAs through processive rounds of amino peptide bond formation. So you can get sub-reactions to work on tRNAs by using just you know, maybe an RNA that has just this domain up here or just this domain down here, but you can't get the whole range of its biological activities without the whole structure. Yes?
When you look at a secondary structure, you get the impression that the sort of non-pair region may have a lower density of the charge.
Yes.
So is it often the case?
So do these loops, for example, have a lower charge density? So it depends a lot on the loops. What people are discovering is that many of the so-called, you know, loops are in fact quite ordered, and there can be hydrogen bond and even base, you know, base interactions, base stacking interactions across the loop that in fact hold it into a well-defined conformation. And so in some cases you can actually have very high local charge density rather than yes, that's correct. Now other sequences, loop sequences, appear to be less well-ordered, at least in, you know, when they're on their own. And so then you could have a very large, you know, set of conformations, and it's quite possible that the overall charge density there is lower. Because certainly in the absence of other contacts, if you don't have contacts that would stabilize a compact structure, then naturally the phosphates should, you know, repel each other, and you would expect that less compact structures should be favored.
What would be that driving force to make
it compact?
Make it even more compact.
So in general, what would drive RNAs to be compact? And so it would be, you know, again, opposed by the phosphate repulsion and by entropy, but favored by the stacking interactions among the bases. The local hydrogen bond contacts are actually also favorable in that environment. And then, it'll be in a cartoon a couple slides from now, but we also, there's probably also not an insignificant effect of sort of counter-ion mediated interactions in which, particularly for multivalent ions, you can imagine that after you form an ion pair between a magnesium, say, and one phosphate, the net charge there is still plus one. So you can still have Coulombic interactions between that residual plus one on the magnesium and some other phosphate elsewhere. In the RNA. And so these Coulombic interactions, of course, would be sufficiently long range to help favor these compact structures. No, it's not specific. So that would provide an overall driving force, but would not provide specificity of the structure. And so then the question is whether the specificity is entirely arising from the RNA-RNA interactions among the bases, or whether there is some additional specificity that's arising from sort of unique sort of ligand-type interactions between groups on the RNA and the metal ions. This gives me a good chance to go on to the next transparent slide, because <That's why. laughs> I had an example of one of these that comes from a crystal structure in the HIV. This is from an RNA that forms part of the HIV dimerization site, and this was determined by Dumas and co-workers from Strasbourg. And it's a really beautiful example of, at least in the crystal lattice, of some ions. These are magnesium ions. They're little yellow spheres over here and blue spheres over here. They can see in the electron density, and in fact there's direct coordination here between the metal ion and oxygens that are coming from the phosphate. So while, as far as people can tell, the large bulk of the magnesium ions remain fully hydrated, there is the possibility that the aqua ligands of the metal ion can be displaced in favor of an oxygen or a nitrogen coming from the RNA itself.
What's the important thing for tertiary structure? Can the rest of the magnesium be replaced by sodium?
In this structure, no.
No, these are obviously.
Yeah. But in general, yeah. Well, no, that's a good question. I don't know if I'll make it to the rest. But at the end, so we have a case where of an RNA where it looks like many of the tertiary interactions can be supported by monovalent ions. So there, as long as you neutralized sufficiently well, the charge on the phosphate, so that the polymer is closer to neutral. The RNA-RNA contacts are apparently sufficient to put it very, very close to the native structure. It's not quite there. There's a few places in the active site that appear to require magnesium to be in the active configuration. But you can get very close to a stable native tertiary structure. So, and then there are other ribozymes, one from the hepatitis delta RNA that infects humans, and then another from these plant viroid RNAs, the so-called hairpin ribozyme, in which people have evidence that the RNAs are actually catalytically functional in the absence of multivalent ions. But in that case, you require very, very high concentrations of monovalent ions. Yeah. So this introduction was by virtue of a way to say that it's quite apparent from both theoretical and experimental work that there are different ways or different classes, if you wish, of interactions between the counterions and the nucleic acid. Of course, one is just very delocalized, non-specific interactions that are recapitulated by simple counterion condensation theory. But because the structure of the folded RNA is unique and complex, there can be very high, local regions of very high electronegative charge density that now make certain regions along the RNA very favorable spots for the RNA, the ions to be localized. So you can have some ions sort of sitting in these regions of very high negative charge density, and you can push it even one step further and in some cases have actually direct coordination of the ion by atoms that are being donated from the RNA. And certainly these kinds of things would appear, you would guess, should be the most specific and unique both to the structure of the RNA and then even to the qualities of the ion, its coordination geometry, its rate, its radius, etc. All right. So we started thinking about this, and this was motivated in part by a variety of experiments. But one of the things was that I was telling you earlier that this domain of the tetrahymenoribozyme that folds rapidly, P4P6 domain, was still folding at, say, 1 per second in our experiments. And that's not actually very rapid. And so the question is, why were we not seeing sort of millisecond time constants there, which is what you might naively expect? And it became clear in the course of several experiments that the answer was the counterions, and that if we repeated those experiments in now starting off with much higher ionic strength, so instead of 10 millimolar sodium chloride present in our starting solution, up to 100 or 200 millimolar sodium, now the folding rates increase dramatically, and the folding times are, in the sort of 30 to 50 millisecond range, actually getting hard for us to measure. Yeah. So that suggested that the ability of the RNA to collapse into compact structures was very sensitive to the counterions, and sort of got us thinking about the experiments that I'll try to tell you about. So the idea then that the model that we started off with was that, again, you would expect this large ensemble of structures to be fairly extended in the absence of counterions, and that's supported for the ribozyme by experiments done by Seb Doniak and Dan Hirschlag's lab, in which they've measured the radius of gyration of the ribozyme, this tetrahymenoribozyme, using small angle X-ray scattering, and they get an answer of about, say, 74 angstroms for the RNA in the absence of magnesium. But once you start adding enough counterion, the counterion, of course, is going to neutralize the charge. So now the RNA chain can begin to explore conformations that are more compact on average. And indeed, they find that the radius of gyration decreases quite dramatically. So for these intermediates, they got, I think, about 51 angstroms or something. And then we know from a variety of biochemical experiments, primarily in Tom Cech's lab, that magnesium in this case, or manganese, is really required for this ribozyme to reach its catalytically active or native structure. This is the most compact structure. It's about 48 angstroms, I think, is the radius of gyration. So we know that magnesium is required to form the native structure, but the question is whether other counter ions would be sufficient to stabilize these other compact states, and if so, what kind of effect would this have on the folding kinetics and the nature of intermediate states that are produced? So we stumbled upon the fact that we could use this native gel assay, again, our little humble approach, to look at this. And so these were experiments done by Susan Heilman-Miller. And what she did, again, was incubate the RNA in some counter ion and then load it on the gel. The gel and the running buffer contain magnesium chloride, sufficient to stabilize the native structure once it is formed. And so again, if we start off with if the sample has no magnesium and you load it on the gel, you get this smear of alternative states. If you pre-incubate the RNA and magnesium before you load it on the gel, you see the native RNA. But it turns out that the same thing will work if you use sodium chloride instead. So if she pre-incubates the RNA in increasing concentrations of sodium chloride, and then loads that sample onto a gel which is containing magnesium, what we see is that, again, now the RNA is migrating as this compact structure. Yes.
You said that these misfolded are the not the native ones, but the compact ones, 48 angstrom.
Right.
No.
So the compact non-native is 51. The native is 48. In the Doniak-Kirchhoff experiments.
You can see those in the gel. It's difference between.
The 51 is probably in the conditions they did it under. It's probably stuff that's sort of down in here, I'm guessing, but it's very hard to go from these gels to something like small-angle X-ray scattering. I mean, in general, mobility corresponds to the radius gyration or Stokes radius of the RNA, but it does so in a kind of complicated way.
If there's
only secondary structure but no tertiary interactions, then it's like it's up in here in the gel, and this is native. So this is like 74 angstroms, and this is 48. Does that sort of help a little bit? A little bit. Yeah. But one shouldn't take the. The gels are instructive, but one shouldn't take it too literally as reflecting the dimensions of the RNA. Yeah. So using this method, then, Sue looked at the ability of various counterions to induce this transition. And again, what we're sort of assuming is happening here is that the sodium somehow produced some more ordered state of the RNA that is capable now of very readily forming the native structure in the short time that the RNA is sort of loading into this gel containing magnesium. And whatever this state is, we know it's different than this state, because when you load this state onto the gel, you don't get this compact band. No, it's so experimentally, we can just sort of define this as this transition, and so we can look at the ability of counterions to produce these states. And as you might expect, the efficiency with various counterions induce this depends on the valence of the ions. So about half molar to molar concentrations of monovalent ions are required. We're plotting here the fraction of native versus the logarithm of cation concentration. And about millimolar concentrations of divalent ions are required. Micromolar concentrations of trivalent ions are required. So the midpoint of the transition in cobalt hexamine is about 12 micromolar in this case. So one conclusion from this was that these results paralleled what one might expect from just very simple counterion condensation theory, and in that we would expect multivalent ions to more effectively reduce the charge on the on the RNA, bring it closer to neutral, and that we would also expect the multivalent ions to be a little bit more effective in creating these kind of bridging interactions that I was speaking about later, where you could have an ion interacting with multiple phosphates at once. Yes, people are nodding, because this has also been seen in DNA experiments on DNA condensation. Yes, Peter.
Is it significant that the magnesium curve, transition is much sharper?
Yes, it is. So that was yes, and that is another take-home message from this. Absolutely, all of these transitions are somewhat cooperative with respect to the counterion concentration, but the one in magnesium is far more cooperative than any of the others. The one in spermidine is one of the least, as you can just see from looking at this is the isotherm for spermidine. The other Hill constants vary somewhere from being about 2 to being about 11 or 12. Yes, I took out the slide just because it was complicated, but Sue did do experiments to check the catalytic activity. And if you pre-incubate the ribozyme in one of these counterions, but no magnesium, and then you add magnesium and substrate at low temperature, and look to see the magnitude of the burst of substrate cleavage, which will give you an estimate of what fraction of the ribozyme is catalytically active. What you'll see is that, you know, somewhere between 70 and 90% of the ribozyme will turn over in that burst if you pre-incubate in the counterion, saturating concentrations of the counterion. If you do not do that pre-incubation and you just add magnesium and substrate sort of right in there, then again, you see very low levels of activity that, you know, increase with time as the ribozyme starts to fold, but it's precisely what you expect. So, yeah, I'm sorry I took the slide out, but it suggested that what we were seeing on the gels really reflected the formation of native RNA. But again, the magnesium is required for the activity. If you add these counterions and you eliminate the magnesium, you see no catalysis.
So, in general,
yes. Yes. Yeah, Hervé's pointing out that's always a problem in RNA, whether the magnesium is important for structure or is important for activity. These are very difficult things to disentangle. I think I just told you about this. What we guess is contributing at least to the efficiency of the multivalent ions is their ability to mediate these attractive interactions, electrostatic interactions. Of course, the other part of this is that the entropy of transitions in monovalent and multivalent ions will be different because many more monovalent ions must be localized around the nucleic acid to achieve the same reduction in net charge as multivalent ions. And so there's certainly an entropic penalty for localizing the monovalent ions. Yes?
What's
the special?
So you had this slide before, but there was another ion that was catching charges, barium.
Yes.
Have
correct. Yes, and calcium is in between, although it's not on this slide. Yes, that's what we think. That it has to do with the radius of the ion size.
Which one is smallest?
Magnesium. Calcium is next, and barium is the largest. Yes.
So what's the
mechanism? For size.
Yes,
that's right. There's a packing problem here.
Has anybody tried beryllium?
Beryllium? Oh,
yes.
Not to my knowledge. We never have.
It's
a good idea. We've never tried it.
Of
course, we're already using cacodyl buffer, which is arsenic. So that's yeah. So the size, so since we're talking about size, of course, the difference between cobalt and spermidine is a very large difference in size and distribution of the charge, completely different. And although the spermidine is more effective than the divalent ions, certainly the midpoint is, you know, it's about 55 micromolar or something, I think, is the midpoint for this limiting transition. Okay, so then the next thing was to look at the rate of this transition, because if the, of course, the interactions between the counterions and the RNA should occur, you know, it should be diffusion controlled, which we estimate to be between 2 and 10 microseconds at the concentrations that we're using here. But so the question was, is whether that is sufficient just to have the ion sort of condense around the RNA, or whether there are some further transitions that must occur in order for us to see this ordered intermediate. And as you can see from the rate constants, I'm just showing you some of the data, these rate constants are in fact quite slow. So there's some kind of further conformational change or reordering of the RNA that's required here in order for us to observe this sort of native-like, you know, compact structure. The rate constants also vary with the valence of the ion. So these transitions are slow in multivalent ions compared to monovalent ions. I think I just have cartoons mostly coming up. Yeah, so this is just a cartoon of what I just told you, which is that we have to infer that the initial states that are produced after the counterions interact with the RNA are still quite disordered. So we have a very large ensemble of structures, and we again expect that the vast majority of these are non-native, and that time is required for the RNA chain to reorder to a topology that's at least compatible with rapid folding to the native structure. And we guess that this must, for example, involve overcoming this tendency of this P3 helix to mispair, that alternative secondary structure I told you about. Because if we know if the RNA has that alternative secondary structure or is predisposed to form it, that we will see, you know, very slow folding rates. And in the gel, once you add a little bit of magnesium, you can trap out sort of these various partially folded structures. And what I just told you, it's another cartoon, is that the rates of these transitions vary quite a bit depending on the counterion. And so we infer from this that the structures that are being produced by the monovalent ions are less stable, and we also guess that they are much less compact and therefore have fewer interactions, again, that are stabilizing the structures. Compared to the kinds of structures that would be produced in multivalent ions. Yep. And so the other thing that I'll just go through very quickly, spermidine is a little bit special in that although it can stabilize compact structures at fairly low concentrations, The rate constants are much more rapid, much greater than in cobalt hexamine, for example, or magnesium or barium, beginning to approach, not quite, but beginning to approach the kinds of rate constants that you would see in monovalent salts. And so we don't entirely understand why this is the case. It certainly fits with our idea that that larger ions, in this case now a polyamine, should be produce slightly more extended structures on average than multivalent metal ions, because the polyamines can pack less efficiently around the nucleic acid. But we don't know if this is really the whole story. It may be that really the better way to understand spermidine is to think of it as sort of three ammoniums kind of tethered together. Maybe that's a better way of thinking of those properties. There's a lot of data. We've also looked at the rate, the dependence of the rates on counterion concentration, and we don't have to go through all these curves, but maybe just look at the transitions in cobalt hexamine. And what you can see is that at very low concentrations, and this turns out to span concentration, these concentrations span the region over which the thermodynamic transition is occurring. So this is about the midpoint of the thermodynamic transition, 12 micromolar, and we're going up to 100 micromolar, at which point the thermodynamic transition is complete. And under these conditions, the rate constant is increasing with cobalt hexamine. So that suggests that under these conditions, we're in a regime in which it's the transitions from the extended to the native structure that are really rate determining. And hence, as you stabilize those compact structures with more cobalt hexamine, you increase the overall rate. So here again, the relative stabilities of the native structure and the extended structures or the misfolded structures are sort of nearly the same. But then we cross into a regime, and you see this in all the counter ions, in which the overall rate of folding is now decreasing as you add increasing amounts of counter ion. And this is what we saw with magnesium chloride before. And so here we presume that we're now again in one of these regimes in which it's the need to unfold these non-native structures, these competing structures, that's really rate determining. And in fact, we've done some experiments in which we add urea to reactions in cobalt hexamine. And if you add urea to reactions in this regime, the urea decreases the rate of folding, again consistent with the idea that it's the ability to form the compact structure in the first place that's rate determining. Whereas if you add urea to reactions in this regime, the urea increases the rate of folding, again consistent with the interpretation that it's the requirement to unfold the intermediates that's rate determining in this case. I think I may have one more cartoon just to sort of sum up where we are so far. So again, our picture of what is going on that's supported not only by experiments in my lab but in many other labs suggests that that the RNA can again achieve compact structures in the presence of counterions, and we expect that this collapse is fairly rapid, and that certainly agrees with the data that are available so far from small X-ray angle scattering experiments, and certainly agrees to some extent with our hydroxyl radical footprinting experiments, although we're expecting this collapse to occur even faster than the second time scale, but probably to be more on the order of a microsecond to low millisecond time scale. But at least for this ribozyme, the tetrahymena ribozyme, this initial collapse is not a very specific process, and it gives rise to a large ensemble of a structure, so a disordered state. And it takes some time for these structures to rearrange and finally achieve the native structure. And so by and large, what we typically see in our experiments is we're really looking at these transitions, these reordering transitions, and those are going to be, of course, very sensitive to the nature and the stability of the intermediates. So sequence, counterions, you know, many different parameters will affect this. And Hervé asked me in the break whether we know whether the energies of the transition states are varying. Is it that we're just changing the free energies of the intermediates, and all these intermediates must completely unfold and then refold again, or in fact, are we changing the barriers, you know, the actual heights of the barriers that are connecting these states? And from experiments, we can't answer this question yet, but it's an interesting one to try to answer. So I put in a few more slides, but I think we save these for another time. Reiterating what I already said in response to questions, that we have a situation, I can go to the very last slide. We have a situation, it's very small RNA. Okay. It's another one of these group 1 ribozymes, but it's much smaller. It's missing many of the other domains. And in this RNA, what we stumbled on from experiments was that the tertiary structure, again, can largely form in the presence of many monovalent ions. Actually, again, the smallest ones are the most effective. Lithium and sodium are the best. Cesium is the least effective. So it looks like much of the tertiary structure will form, but there are a few key spots indicated by the red dots, red balls, that are right at the active site near where the substrate is cleaved, that seem to require magnesium in order to become fully ordered. And that fits again with the experimental fact that this this ribozyme again requires magnesium to be catalytically active. So,
again, it's not clear that magnesium is needed for function or structure.
No, absolutely. That's right. So we know that that there are, so from footprinting experiments, which I just glossed through.
What is TB? Is this terbium?
This terbium, yes. Yeah. Sorry.
Does it appear in nature?
Terbium. Oh, probably.
Probably
not. Yes. So people have used terbium as a substitute for magnesium.
Okay.
We see the same. So this is a mapping points at which the RNA is hydrolyzed in the presence of terbium, low concentrations of terbium. And we get the same positions if we look at sites that are hydrolyzed by magnesium hydroxide. But the magnesium reaction is very inefficient. So you are asking me, structure and function. So we know from the footprinting experiments, the hydroxyradical cleavage experiments, that there are subtle changes in the conformation of the RNA when you add magnesium. And they're limited to residues that are right in this portion of the sequence. So there's certainly some small change in the conformation of the RNA. But you're absolutely correct. Sort of separating that from coordination of the substrate helix, which is shown right here, and chemistry is very difficult. Very difficult. Yeah.
Is there any evidence that might suggest that this ensemble of compact but non-native structures might be reduced, therefore increasing the rate to the native structure during synthesis in vivo, where you're starting at a 5' end, and so you have a folding occurring in a, as it's being synthesized instead of from the
homologue. Yes, yes. The question is the spectrum of compact intermediates that would arise as the RNA is being synthesized in vivo be smaller? So you'd have a smaller ensemble of states and then perhaps a faster transition to the native structure as a result. And I don't know in vivo. we have a little data in vivo. But we know in vitro that we're still getting a very large ensemble of structures. But we don't know whether we simply haven't correctly recapitulated the situation in vivo yet in our experiments or not. So we've been fussing around with polymerases that extend the chain at different rates. It turns out that, you know, magnesium concentration, no surprise, is very important. And it may be, you know, all driven by sequence. So we've been permuting the sequence of the RNA to see if you start at different positions along the chain, so presumably the interactions are forming in different order, whether that will now change. And again, we still are seeing a lot of intermediates in all cases. So I suspect that for this RNA, at least in vitro, we're still getting competition between alternative structures, and it's still a pretty broad ensemble of states. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
You have shown two specific examples.
Yes.
Do you think that this is a general feature of forming RNA shear structure? And as a result, if you think about this artificially designed ribosome, would they behave the same?
So behave the same, you mean be prone to becoming trapped in misfolded structures and et cetera? I think yes. And actually, it's an interesting. So, in fact, actually, it's an interesting question. The in vitro, the artificial ribozymes that have been sort of selected in vitro, right? So they have a very short evolutionary history. Yeah. And if anything, I'm actually guessing that those sequences are less well optimized than the natural sequences. And in fact, when you talk to people who do those experiments, they see one of two things: either only a small fraction of their RNA population reacts, and the way the experiments are done, that's fine, they don't care. But a lot of it is misfolded, or something's wrong with it. Or alternatively, it depends the way the selection is done. Some cases, they're waiting for very, very long times during their selection procedure, especially early on, where they don't have very many active sequences. If they wait long enough, I guess presumably, all the RNAs will have a chance to fold. So I was having a conversation with Dave Bartel. We're talking about that it would be interesting to do one of these selections where you actually try to change the conditions that you set on the chain for its ability to fold, you know, under some prescribed conditions and time, you know, whatever. And I don't think anybody's examined that in a highly systematic way yet, but. But I think the general principles that I think, I'm guessing that almost every RNA that people look at, you will find that there's some potential to be being trapped. And that I think the response to counter ions will be general, you know, all of these things. The details will vary, but I think the general things will probably be true. So far from what people have done, not only, you know, my lab at and Williamson Lab and by Taupan and Tobin Sazek, who've been working on this RNA-P, they find very similar things on a different RNA. So I think it's consistent.
How about specific binding sites for ions? Is that general for RNA
molecules? From what people know, yes. Yeah. So again, you'll have a mixture of very non-specific and then some a few specific sites.
Okay. These are all the questions.
Thanks for lots of good comments.
Were you planning on telling us some more about the ionic effects, or was that?
That's actually everything. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, so, I guess I have been asked by several people that Peter Schuster might tell us a little bit more about these neural network evolution. So I would suggest that we would do that tomorrow morning at 10.
Okay.
And also for those people who thought that tomorrow is an empty day, in the afternoon, Chen Leiter will be talking. I'm not quite sure, on campus, it doesn't have to do anything with us. I'm not quite sure where.
Bioengineering
at 2 p.m.
Yeah,
so I tried to find out the room number until this afternoon, but I assume that many people want to be there. So then we meet this afternoon at 2 p.m. for our wait, and tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Thank you again. And dinner, as usual, we want to go out this evening at 6:30.